So a reading has been selected to start or to set the tone for our lecture today on the Zohar, and it is excerpts from The Voice of the Silence. Alas, alas, that all men should possess a lyre, be one with the great soul, and that possessing it, a lyre should so little avail them. A lyre is reflected by the small and by the great, is mirrored in the tiniest atom, yet fails to reach the heart of all. Alas, that so few men should profit by the gift, the priceless boon of learning truth, the right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent. Of teachers, there are many. The master soul is one. Alaya, the universal soul. Live in that master as its ray in thee. Live in thy fellows as they live in it. Thou hast to saturate thyself with pure Alaya, become as one with nature's soul thought. All is impermanent in man except the pure bright essence of Alaya. That beam is thy life guide and thy true self. Compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws, eternal harmony, Alaya's self, a shoreless universal essence, the light of everlasting right and fitness of all things, the law of love eternal. The more thou dost become one with it, thy being melted into its being, the more thy soul unites with that which is, the more thou wilt become compassion absolute. So, for the month of February and April, we have been looking at to various sacred scriptures, various sacred texts around the world. And this morning, we are finishing up that series with a consideration of the Zohar. And it might be a good opportunity for us to not only explore the Zohar, but also take consideration of what we mean by the sacred and what are the qualities and influences of sacred texts in general. So we'll start today with a invitation to the study of the Zohar by Simeon ben Yohai, which he gave to his few disciples 1900 years ago. Come and see. The stories of the Torah are only the outer garment. The wise see beyond the garment and behold the soul. Every word is a hidden key. Every letter is a doorway. All matters in the Torah are of superior nature and are uppermost secrets. Zohar, Part 1, page 152. The Zohar explores the inner meaning of the five books of Moses and the mysteries of the soul. It originates from the same sacred impulse as the Upanishads and the Dhammapada. It has the power to guide lives, awaken the heart, and shape civilizations. The Hebrew word Zohar means radiance, a word symbolizing that it is a book that contains and reveals the sacred illuminating essence of divine wisdom. A sacred text is a gate, a point of passage between the visible and invisible, the world of form and the world of spirit. In the symbolism of the Zohar, a gate represents a degree of spiritual enlightenment. There are many gates to wisdom in the Zohar. This presentation will focus on the Zohar as a gate to knowledge of the sacred. The Zohar contains stories and symbolic images to present its profound metaphysical, ethical, and psychological teachings. Even the original language it was written in, Aramaic, is an ancient poetic and mystical language, and it gives to the text a sacred tone. Its metaphysics and philosophical principles form its head doctrine and appeal to the intellect, while its psychological insights and ethical teachings form its sacred heart doctrine and appeal to intuition and compassion. Our goal today is to get a working knowledge of its philosophical principles and learn the keys that it offers to create, sustain, and resuscitate the sacred within our soul, our relationships, the conduct of our lives, and to realize the sacred around us, a realization that is often hidden from the truth. It's hidden from view. So what is the Zohar? In the words of the Zohar, this is a book of the concealed. Its words are the key to the higher secrets, the path to sublime wisdom. The Zohar is the crown jewel, the central text of esoteric mystical Judaism, or what is generally called the Kabbalah. Its authorship, if not its origin, is assigned to Simeon ben Yohai, an adept rabbi who lived in Jerusalem around the second century AD. Its religious mysteries were taught by him directly to only a few of his closest disciples who wrote them down. His work is a bridge between the older Chaldean Kabbalah, called the Book of Numbers, and a significantly edited version published in Spain in 1280 AD by Rabbi Moses de Leon. Drawing upon surviving literary fragments of the teachings of Ben Yochai and other mystics, de Leon fashioned what has become to be known as the written Zohar. While there are differences of form and expression in the latter version by de Leon, its doctrines remain true to the fundamental principles in the original version of Ben Yochai. The Zohar is not a single text, but it is a compendium of many texts written in a style which is poetic and symbolic, as commentaries, discussions, parables, and sermons. Selecting key words or verses from the five books of Moses, the Zohar expands with four different levels of interpretation: the literary narrative of the text, the moral and ethical significance of the text, its symbolic and allegorical consideration, and lastly, its esoteric and mystical meaning. Its chief text is called the Book of Concealed Mystery, or the Sifra Zenuta. This book, we are told, was compiled from the same original ancient source as the Chaldean Book of Numbers and the stanzas of the Book of Zohar, upon which the secret doctrine is based. However, the Zohar acknowledges that its true esoteric meaning goes beyond the written text, which serves as a veil to the uninitiated. As Rabbi Ben Yochai said to his disciples, if the five chapters of the Book of Concealed Wisdom include the entire wisdom, then they are the best, and there is no need to study further. This is true for one who has entered wisdom and come out of it in peace. He can see here the incorporation of the entire wisdom. But it is not so for one who did not enter wisdom and emerge from it in peace. In an article called Tetragrammaton, HPB writes, having studied the Kabbalah for nearer 40 than 30 years, I may perhaps be allowed to regard the Zohar as a legitimate ground for me to stand upon. Considering this quote by HPB, the Zohar deserves the attention of every serious student of theosophy. So today, we are going to look at some of its fundamental ideas so that we get a grasp of the Zohar upon which we can stand. These ideas are the heart of its teaching on the sacred, and they can be applied to cleanse our natures and remove the obstacles to progress mentally, morally, and spiritually. They are a formula that can be applied to unlock the mysteries of the cosmos and the soul. The first of these ideas is naturally the deific principle, or what is called in the Zohar, Ein Sof, except to say that it is the one infinite unity and reality, which is the source of all beings. It cannot be described in words, as it is beyond human thought, language, and comprehension. However, one can say what it is not. Hence, the word Ein Sof means that which is no thing and it has no end. It has no attributes, nor can it directly use or relate to any manifested thing. It is the unknowable light, which is darkness to human perception. It is the eternal, boundless, unknowable, and hidden principle of sacredness, which is beyond all form, differentiation, and comprehension. Yet its sacredness pervades every point in space, all differentiated forms, and unifies all intelligent beings. According to the Zohar, the journey of the human soul is to remove the veils of illusion and acquire a deeper understanding of that divine sacred unity in the world behind the veils of duality, diversity, separateness, and to learn to live accordingly. Ein Sof, the deific principle, can only be comprehended through its manifested aspects in time and space, as it is unknowable. It is these finite aspects which can have a direct relation to the manifested universe. In their totality, these aspects are called Eitz Chaim, the tree of life. In their collectivity, they are identical to the idea of the manifested logos, or the word, called debar in Hebrew. In their individuality, they are called the words, debarim, the Sephiroth, numbers, or the Elohim. The Zohar identifies in general 10 Sephiroth. Three are on the higher spiritual plane, and seven are on the four lower descending planes of manifestation. The 10 Sephiroth are manifesting attributes of the unknowable Ein Sof. They are also symbolic of hierarchies of intelligent creative forces operating on different planes of being. These creative beings are the cosmic agents or channels through which divine light, energy, and wisdom manifest in the universe, according to the Zohar. A central teaching of the Zohar is that all that which is manifested in the lower visible world has its correspondence in the invisible upper world. The lower and the higher act and react upon each other. The Zohar describes a direct relation and correspondence between the Sephiroth and the human being. The sevenfold human being emanates from the sevenfold Sephiroth. Consequently, these 10 Sephiroth are called in their collectivity the heavenly man, the first Adam, or Adam Kadmon. The 10 Sephiroth, or hierarchies of intelligent creative forces, are considered by the Zohar to be sacred channels for the manifestation of the unmanifested, boundless, eternal sacredness of Ein Sof. The different Sephiroth partake of sacredness according to their degree of differentiation from the one infinite reality and the materiality of the plane upon which they are operating. Every function and influence of the Sephiroth in the evolution and operation of the universe, a world, or human being is considered to be a sacred action because of the sacredness of the guiding underlying intelligent spiritual impulse. Hence, the sacredness of cosmic law. In our introduction, we had a reading from the Voice of the Silence on the nature of Elia, the light of the world, universal soul. In Hebrew, or in the Kabbalah, this is called Shekinah. Shekinah is the manifesting divine presence that pervades the universe, the world, and human soul. It is the one spirit manifesting as divine light, wisdom, and grace. It is the collective light of the Sephiroth. As the light of Shekinah is the first expression in time, space, and matter of the eternal absolute, unknowable light of Ein Sof, it corresponds to the light of the manifested Logos, which is simultaneously an intelligent and creative potency. The Zohar teaches that the wisdom and potency of Shekinah reside in the upper triad of the human being, the immortal ego, Atma Buddhi Manas, as expressed in Theosophy. Shekinah may be felt by many, but it is only fully revealed to the enlightened mind. It is veiled by ignorance. As Theosophy teaches, it is attainable, possessed, and directed by the immortal ego of the adept. Shekinah is the presence of the collective divine sacredness of the Sephiroth, knowable to the human soul through devotion and meditation, and witnessed as cosmic harmony in the universe. And as we heard, it is Elia, and it is compassion, the law of laws. One idea that initially sounds unique to the Kabbalah, but we see is actually found throughout theosophy and other philosophical and religious traditions, is that of tikkun. Tikkun originally meant the archetypal man, Adam Kadmon, meaning in the Zohar that the sephirot in their totality were the ideal macrocosmic prototype of which humanity is the microcosmic manifestation on earth. Or, as we might say, as above, so below. Man is the microcosm of the macrocosm. Every human principle has its corresponding sephirot from which it was produced and to which it is related. The human principles and their corresponding sephirot act and react upon one another. Now, the Zohar teaches that there are five levels or aspects of soul. And these five levels are soul, as taught in the Zohar, are nefesh, ruach, neshama, mechila, and yehida. Now, there are two other words that correspond to what we might call the vehicles of soul, the astral body and physical body. But for now, we're just speaking of these five levels of soul. And they do, even though there's five of them, they do correspond to the principles we know of in theosophy as lower mind, kama manas, kama, the immortal ego, the thinker, the spiritual ego, buddhi manas, the buddhi, as well as atma, the higher self. So those principles we understand in theosophy are expressed in the Kabbalah by different terms. The highest level of soul, yehida or atma, is already within, but one has to access it. These five levels of soul are not separate from one another. It's not the idea that we have five souls, but are interconnected with one another and the cosmos. So they are interconnected aspects, each of which has a connection with the higher worlds, is an emanation of those higher aspects. The human soul is a bridge then between the spiritual realms of the universal and the material world we are familiar with. The human soul, partaking of a spark or ray of the divine, Atma, and connected with the physical world. So the human soul is both connected with the physical world and yet contains a spark of the spiritual, the higher self. In the process of manifestation and differentiation and evolution, every spark or ray of the divine archetypal man, the Logos, descends into the material world of being, according to the Kabbalah. Every human's soul has the potentiality of the same creative power as its archetypal source. This makes the human soul a sacred agent. The duty of every human soul is to restore and preserve cosmic harmony and elevate the divine sparks trapped within matter. In the later version of the Zohar, Tikkun refers more specifically to this divine human relationship. Human action has a profound cosmic effect in the spiritual realm, which makes individual spiritual action a sacred task and responsibility. A human being participates in the sacred work of Tikkun through the performance of ethical deeds, kindness, spiritual intention, and the striving for balance and harmony within oneself and with others. The human soul is the real human being and is immortal, and there is inherent sacredness in the immortal human soul. one of the key ideas in theosophy, and as well the Zohar and Kabbalah, is that of reincarnation and the soul's journey. Reincarnation, the cycles of the soul, is called Gilgulim Neshemot in the Zohar. Souls are reborn in order to perfect themselves and complete their unfinished work. According to the Zohar, there are three main reasons for reincarnation: the correction or rectification of a transgression of the law of harmony, and the necessity to reincarnate until the transgression ceases and harmony is restored. Two, failure to fulfill a necessary and obligatory duty. And three, reincarnation in order to help others. The spiritual essence or spark of the immortal human soul is one with and inseparable from Ein Sof. As the soul incarnates into forms of matter, it loses its connection with its divine source. Exile in Zohar is disconnection of the soul with its divine source, resulting in disharmony, or what is called shattering, shvirat, in the terminology of the Zohar. The soul incarnates with the purpose of reuniting itself with its divine source and assisting other sparks of the divine to return to their original state of purity. Rectification of harmony, or tikkun, occurs when the disturbed harmony is restored within oneself, with others, and with the cosmos. Every human action either disturbs or rectifies cosmic harmony, and these actions rebound back upon the human soul, causing suffering or benefit. So we see in the Zohar an expression of that law of karma, universal harmony and balance, action and reaction. A person's situation and circumstances in any incarnation are one's responsibility, as they are caused by the state of shattering or rectification in one's soul. In other words, there is no karma unless there is a being to make it and feel its effects. The soul's journey through reincarnation completes the sacred duty to acquire deeper awareness of the divine unity and sacredness that underlies all and to live accordingly. Every human life is sacred in this regard. Every human situation is a sacred opportunity, and every human action can be a sacred service. And now we come to a sister doctrine of karma, that of cycles, the universal law of cycles. Durations of time are cyclical, according to the Zohar. They are spiritual in their original impulse. The influence of the Sephiroth occurs progressively and repetitively in a definite cyclical order over time. Time unfolds in an ebb and flow of spiritual energies from the Sephiroth, imparting sacred influences of varying degrees upon certain hours of the days, days of the week, times of the month, year, and even longer durations of cosmic time. Under this law and the sacred influence coloring durations of time, there are certain times that are best for initiating spiritual energy, certain times when we are spiritually challenged, and certain times when it is best for spiritual reflection and integration. So we hear the idea, the idea of living the life, meditation, and the work that we have to do on ourselves. Using time wisely, excuse me, using time unwisely or ignorantly exiles the divine presence within, while using time wisely with knowledge and living in alignment with the sacred rhythms of life bring a beneficial influence and help. Nevertheless, every moment in time is an opportunity to connect with the divine within. A moment in time becomes sacred when it becomes fully present, purposeful, and full of awareness. Space is sacred in the absolute abstract sense as it is one with the Ein Sof, but it is also sacred in its manifested fullness of the four lower worlds, since the divine presence of Shekinah pervades the lower worlds. The lower worlds, the Sephiroth and our human principles, are not separate from one another, as they ultimately exist in space, which itself is one, even though sevenfold in its manifestation. According to the Zohar, all the creative potential forces and substances of these worlds and Sephiroth exist within the human being and within the human soul. The human soul has potential access to all those dimensions, all those worlds. The human principles have their relationship to the four lower worlds and are also sacred in their respective degrees, but none is completely devoid of sacred potential. According to the cycles in time, there may be specific areas and locations on Earth that are impressed with a higher degree of divine influence and sacredness. Nevertheless, because of the creative spiritual power inherent in the human soul, every place or state of being, physical, vital, astral, psychic, mental, moral, or spiritual, has the potential to express the sacred if it is cleansed of its dross and set apart for spiritual purpose by the free will and choice of the human soul. There is no place, within or without, internal or external, that cannot become a sacred temple for the purposes of the soul, performing actions and duties with spiritual intent and effect. When human beings read aloud, chant, pray, or speak, especially with spiritual intention, they activate the latent divine power within numbers, letters, words, and awaken the corresponding Sephiroth. And this is why the sacred texts are so valuable, because within their letters, words, and names are potencies that can arouse the very highest in us and arouse the presence of us, of the sacred in our lives. So we'd like to conclude. Of course, there is much more that we could say about the Zohar, but we'd like to conclude with two final statements from Simeon ben Yochai to his disciples and to us. When the companions sit together and occupy themselves with these mysteries, the Shekinah rests upon them, and they are friends above and below. Come and see. When the companions sit together, the Shekinah spreads her wings over them. And that concludes our presentation. So we're opening a gate with just a few keys, and we are sure that from your own thoughts and studies that you have many questions or comments on these ideas or on the Zohar specifically. So we invite your contributions, thoughts at this time. Yes, MDW.
In your talk, you expressed that the reading aloud of sacred books is very helpful. Are you suggesting that perhaps we should read aloud to ourselves?
Well, the sacred texts were passed on orally. They were memorized and passed on orally, even before they were written down. And of course, the written word we know has a potency. We say the pen is mightier than the sword. But the spoken word, because of its relationship to sound and the potency of letters, numbers, vibrations, mantras, if you will, can also have a profound effect. Sacred texts, for example, such as the Bhagavad Gita, were chanted. The literal meaning is song of the Lord. And we know the Homeric poems, which had such a profound influence, were chanted and retold orally through generations. So, in our studies too, as well as our focused concentration and reading, trying to get at the underlying meaning of the words, read between the lines, so to speak, exerting all our mental powers, it is also wise for us to read, because the words themselves can awaken. And well, this is very easy for us to test out. We can, some of us like to read and some of us like to listen to audiobooks. And we know that an experience of the same book, hearing it on audio tape, is a completely different from the experience of reading it. It's hard to say which is better. But I guess that depends on the individual, but we know both are profound in their effect. Any other questions, comments?
There are some chats, a couple of
Okay.
chats.
Oh, we'll see if we can get those. So we have here first a quotation from Chronicles, one of the books, which is not from the five books of Moses. But it's Chronicles, one of the additions to the Old Testament. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, Hesed, and the power, Gevurah, and the glory, Tefillah, and the victory, Netzah, and the majesty, Hod, for all Yesod that is in the heavens and the earth. Malkut Shekinah is yours. One source referenced in the Zohar for the lower Sephiroth on the Kabbalistic tree. So we
Yeah.
have their names, a few of the 10 names given to these various aspects of Shekinah, or divine wisdom, as it manifests in these various lower attributes. And the essence of this quote is that they all are testament to the ultimate glory and grace and sacredness of that one eternal, changeless principle. They are all agents or channels for its manifestation, as are our principles. Our seven principles are all aspects or means by which the higher self, the Atma, the one universal principle, can manifest in different ways. Okay, so we have a contribution here. The version of the Zohar that I found most rewarding in terms of accompanying notes, explanation, references, the Zohar Pritzker edition, 12 volumes. Yes, indeed. We're familiar with this, and not impossible to find, but expensive. But
Get it from the library.
hence the library, if one can get it, or online. But yes, truly, because if one tries to read the Zohar in there are so many allusions and references to biblical passages and expressions that are archaic, that it is very helpful to have the accompanying notes. Now, we might mention that the modern interpretations of the Zohar are go back to a rabbi that lived in the 16th century, who was very instrumental in collating and the works of Simeon ben Yochai and Rabbi De Leon, And it is upon the works of this 16th century rabbi that all our really modern understanding of Kabbalah and the Zohar go back to. So influential was his influence. But yes, it is very useful if one can get a hold of that.
I put a link up. You know,
Okay. Yes, there is a link.
one of the folks on the call this morning has the LAS has the Tree of Life diagram as their icon in the Zoom call. And the link that I put up is a Haifa University has a collection of these iconotexts, these Ilan, these tree diagrams that they have amassed from different periods in history. There's the traditional one that we see it in LAS's icon, but there's a million different permutations.
Yes.
And there's a book that goes along with them that's referenced on that site that is amazing, that has these fold out diagrams. Some of these trees are like the originals are like scrolls that are 10 feet long, and they're covered with you know, just quotes and the attributions of the Sfirot. And it's an iconotext that's critical to the whole Kabbalistic practice, but it's amazing stuff if people are moved to look further. That website has got a database of all the Ilan that they've accumulated, and it's got a link to the book and stuff. But the book is killer, The Kabbalistic Tree by Chayas.
Yeah, yes. The Kabbalistic tree, the tree of life. And there are also great texts on in that same reference series regarding reincarnation or the gate of reincarnation, which goes into details, we would might say, of the Kabbalistic interpretations of the Old Testament to definitively show the presence and the influence and the meaning of that in light of reincarnation. Showing the moral essence. And we might say that the point there is not so much claiming that these relationships of the characters are meant to be taken as authoritative statements of truth, but to rather show that doctrine of reincarnation and its moral influence and its moral significance connected with karma. As a fundamental teaching of the Zohar and the Kabbalah. And so these stories of reincarnation are really more exemplary metaphors or parables on that, just as Jesus used to teach.
There's also a real, I think, a real through line in the Zohar of meditative practice that I would call like the sort of Platonic ascent to the one. You know, the Hekhalot literature, it's the Hebrew word for palaces, and it will the techniques kind of guide the aspirant through you know, it, through meditation to arise through successive heavens until they can have an experience of the divine through meditation. And then there's kind of the associated Merkava literature, the meditations on the Ezekiel's chariot vision. But I think certainly there's all this exegesis of esoteric stuff, like you said, in the five books of Moses. I was also thinking about this morning that we had talked in recent weeks about elementals, and just as an example, you know, in the Zohar, there's discussions of how on the seventh day of creation, spirits that had not yet been incarnated into fleshly vehicles became disembodied spirits. There's also other references in the souls of the generation of the flood, you know, may have would have lingered as disembodied spirits. So there's a throughout the literature, there's just a million sort of esoteric descriptions of all of the mystical content that you don't find in an exoteric reading of the scripture. But there's probably a million things that would key into theosophical interests and sort of explanations of the metaphysics of our world, you know, through that.
Yes. So, key to understanding that contribution, as well as the methods of meditation that are taught in the Kabbalistic tradition, is understanding that relationship between the human and divine, as below, so below, and the idea that we do not live in isolation from the world around us, from the higher spiritual worlds and potencies and intelligences. We are indissolubly connected with them. But what gets in the way are our lower principles, the influences of our body and our senses and our passions and desires, and the way we think. And so, as we may understand from theosophy, the goal of meditation is to purify the lower so that we can become more aware of the higher and allow it to be a more presence in our life. And the whole power of meditation is to open ourselves up to that. Now, there is a little bit different emphasis in the purpose of meditation or the goal, as in the Kabbalah. So, in the Kabbalah, the idea is, as a result of this shattering, there is a separateness, an actual separateness and discontinuation of the world, of the human being, and all the different sephiroth. And the purpose of the meditation and the moral exercises and the life, or what they call tikkun, is to bring this all together, to reestablish the unity, even the unity in the higher triad, as expressed in Kabbalah. In theosophy, it's a little different. The unity is always there; it's underlying. What has be what? What we have become disconnected to it in our consciousness. We're never completely separated, but we believe and think as though we were separated. And so the goal of meditation is to not to unite ourselves with something greater that we have lost contact with, actually, spiritually, but rather to unite ourselves consciously with that which we always were and always will be, that the higher self. So it's a little bit different approach and understanding, but ultimately the aim or the path is one. The path varies with the pilgrim. The aim is through conscious union with the divine, and in the same time, raising up through the way we conduct our lives, all of life around us. Yes, MHW.
One of the things that we have noticed, and we know that this is the last Sunday for this study that we've been doing all month, is the similarities between all these sacred books that we've been looking at. And we just wonder about, if these are similar, so all these different peoples over the course of time put this information down in writing, then we would hope that the similarities, and it was just talked about unity, and also, I mean, studying these books, it's like a perfect example of unity in diversity. And but we know that we never really focused on any of these until we started studying theosophy. And it's a wonderful thing that the similarities between theosophy and these ancient texts, that if more people would understand, maybe would look at them and see how this unity in diversity has gone back so far, that the commonality between us all would be a little more obvious, we think.
Yes, so basically, as was pointed out there, the aim of a sacred text, wherever it originates from, is to help those who read it or understand it or meditate on it or pronounce it to return to the sacred unity of all, that one divine principle. Just as the various colors of the solar spectrum originally come from that one light, they appear separate, but they're ultimately one and united. And so, well, what is a sacred text? We sort of touched on that today, but let's recapitulate it, since a sacred text is sacred because of its content. It's philosophical, ethical, psychological message, and the wisdom of nature that it's based on. In other words, in the Kabbalah, its teachings on the nature of time, on the nature of space, are all based on fundamental recognitions of laws in nature, cosmic laws. Okay. And it's also sacred in the terms of its influence, the way it helps us reform our presence and awareness of the sacred, the divine within us. That's a very sacred process and magical process. How it reforms our sacredness in our relationships with each other, with the world in which we live, and with the divine. It's also sacred in the power and potency of the very letters and words that make up these texts, regardless of what language they're written in, whether it's the original Sanskrit or an English translation. The power and potencies of the words in the Kabbalah, this is called gematria. It's an actual body of knowledge, understanding the secret potencies of numbers and letters and words, and the means by which they can decipher the underlying message within the Torah. But if this is a body of knowledge, it is known by all those great souls who, in their line of influence, help bring forth these sacred texts for us. So it's sacred in terms of the impact it has on our lives. The message, the impact, and the sound, the very words it's written. We thought that it was, in terms of meditation, the use of time. You remember we talked about a time to initiate learning, spiritual progress, a time for spiritual challenge, and a time for spiritual reflection. And we might even say this is equivalent to our periods of meditation, as we talk about in theosophy. It's good for us to begin the day with a period of spiritual intention. What we are planning, setting the tone, just like we set the tone for the beginning of this talk, to take a devotional book or a passage from a sacred text, to think about it, how we're going to apply a spiritual attention. And then throughout the day, that's the cycle, that's the time of our spiritual challenge, where we take that tone, that idea, and this is where the process of tikkun, as described in Kabbalah, or reestablishing the harmony. This is the challenge, because we are exposed to so many corrupted, inharmonious influences in our life, and the effort of the ego, the soul, is to bring it into balance. And then the time for reflection at the end of the day, a period of meditation in which we examine ourselves. Where did we, where were we successful? Where were we? Where can we improve? What can we strengthen? And so this natural cycle, and it tells us to take advantage of the cycles of time, to work with those rhythms in nature. So that's why it's good for us to establish a daily cycle of study, of concentration, even why we try to keep our meetings prompt and on time. And so, in light of that, in that we are drawing to the end of the hour, we'll for now we'll finish off this very interesting discussion and study together, and invite you for next Sunday as we go into the next subject, our next umbrella theme of psychism and spirituality. Thank you. Make it a great day. Our meeting is adjourned.